This podcast is brought to you by The Province.
The Province Sports Podcast.
Hey folks, it's Patrick Johnson here. Quick note as we bring you the post-season podcast live from Woody's Pub in Coquitlam, presentation of Eagle Ridge GM. Small technical glitch, not really sure what happened here, but we managed to lose about the first minute of the recording. So instead of Jeff being the first voice you hear, you'll hear Jason Botchford. Everything else seems to be hunky-dory, so without further ado, over to the fellas.
For their fans, they shouldn't be forgotten, and like I don't think, I honestly don't think I could have done enough in terms of writing how much they meant to the city, how much they meant to me watching these games, and how much they meant to the Vancouver Canucks over that time.
So
No,
you think I've got it in for these guys somehow. Like I'm excited that they're gone now. Like nothing could be further from the truth.
I think that you have a very cold, detached look at it, right? Like
I've got a cold, detached look at everything. Like
so do I mostly. But like aren't you from here? Like
where? See, I think you're upset because I'm coming across as the colder guy in all of this, and that's the role that you want. And I'm like, I'm on your turf in all of this. So you're trying to crowd me out. I was quite frankly, I was shocked. I hadn't noticed this. Somebody pointed it out. Like Henrik's 112 point season hasn't been bested. We're in the McDavid era. Ovechkin at the top of his game. Sidney Crosby is healthy again. Like, this was an amazing year in the National Hockey League. Guys were scoring again. Like, there was offense in this league. Nobody has topped the 112 points that Henrik put up, and that was 8 years ago.
No, and that's, I think it was Canuck Clay, actually, that I saw tweet that out. Yeah, and that's one of the things that sticks with me. One of the things that also, like, when you go back, and, you know, I went back and I looked like, okay, who was making the arguments against Henrik, not like against him winning the Hart that year? Who was making the arguments against Daniel Sedin not winning the Hart the year after that? And it's interesting. It's like, I don't think, like, if you go back and you read comments from media across the country, they did not get their due. They did not get their run as like, holy shit, like, look at this line. They are the best in hockey. The two best offensive players in the game right now are playing on the same line. Like you don't going back and mining all of everything that was written back then. You don't sense that from anywhere else, but in Vancouver. And even in Vancouver, it was, yeah, but like, look what Ryan Kessler's doing. Yeah, but like, look how great their power play is. And they're getting a lot of points there. Yeah, but AV's like playing them a lot, you know, with his offensive zone starts. So were they fully appreciated at their best? Certainly not Canada-wide, certainly not nationally.
Well, I'd take it a step further, and this is not a new argument, but like I think they should have had a higher profile in North America. When you stop and think, like, okay, brother acts happen occasionally in sport, but these guys are freaking identical twins that were at the top of their craft. And not just for a moment, but for a while. Like, we're never going to see that again, ever.
No, and that, I think that bled into, and that part of it was kind of one of the main motivating factors in what happened. Like, look, the last week was over. Like, I was shocked, like, how overwhelming it was, like, and seeing those guys, how overwhelmed they were shocked. I think that they were overwhelmed in a way that they didn't expect it to be. I mean, they both wanted to make the announcement after the season. They didn't want any of this kind of interaction with them and the fans, but ultimately it was really enriching for them. I think it was really enriching for the fans. And it was almost cathartic because there is Sedin guilt in Vancouver. Like there is like a lot of guilt about the way that they were treated early on, the way that people doubted them early on. And I went back and I read tons of columns from 2000 right up to 2004 from Ed, from Speck, from Tony, from all the big columnists across the country. and all it was really super consistent. No, like everyone thought topping out, they would be secondary scorers in the NHL. That was the best they could be. And they blew those expectations out of the water, and they did it later in their careers, which is pretty odd. So I think that there is an element of like guilt being washed away in that final week when it was ovation after ovation, nothing but love after nothing but love.
And I want to take a sec just to give the Edmonton Oilers and their fans some credit, because under difficult circumstances, against the backdrop of the Humboldt tragedy on the Friday afternoon, the Twins played their final game in Edmonton on Saturday, and I thought the Oilers hit all the right notes in the pregame ceremony, and the way that they acknowledged the Twins with a quick video, and the fans there responded, and every time they were up on the Jumbotron, the fans, and there were a lot of Canuck fans in the building as well that night, but that postgame ceremony too, everything about it, and the kids on the bench that had to get to you, you can't let it go. The hatred that you have for Chris Russell and his stick robbing Henrik Sedin of, like, Daniel had his moment on Thursday and Henrik had he was that close. And Chris Russell reached out and robbed Henrik of the mic drop moment.
I did say to them, like, send me, like, I need to be there. Like, I should be there. And they said no. So, like, that's how, you know, maybe I will just for that reason pass on all the Besser stories that I am planning for the next week. But there were two villains in the final week. And I want to put an asterisk after the Sedin point totals. The Henrik Sedin, Daniel Sedin, asterisk, two of them. One for Gallant, who did the review, a total asshole move. In a game he didn't care about, where he threw out his backup goalie, he was sitting guys like two of his top six players, had already clinched his division, the game didn't matter at all, and after, like, Ashton Sautner goes out there, scores his first career goal, it's set up by the Sedins in their second last game, and this fucking guy has to go out there and get on his iPad and call a review that takes forever and gets the goal pulled out of history. Villain number one, asterisk number one, 2 points taken away from the Sedins that should be on their ledger. 2 more points taken away in the overtime game where they would have gone out in the most magical way possible. 2 OT winners in 2 straight games, and Mr. Blocking Shots, Chris Russell, has to extend that stick over the goal line in a game that meant nothing to him. It meant nothing to his team. It meant everything to history. And he had to take that moment away from them, away from us, away from this city, away from Woody's, away from everyone. Why would he have to do that? And I already can't stand the guy. I can't stand the way he plays. I can't stand the way he's propped up by, you know, mainstream media is like this, you know, gritty defenseman out there. Like, so much of, like, what I hear out of Delzato, I hear about Chris Russell. I can't stand either of them because of it. I hated the whole Ham Hughes, Chris Russell argument. That still bothers me. Why couldn't he let it go? It was going right into the net. Henrik had taken the shot. The goalie was beat. Why does he have to block? I still don't understand it. I don't understand it to this day. I wish I was there to ask him. I wouldn't have even gone in. You're right. That last game was filled with emotion. The baby Sedins on the bench, there were tears. All I cared about was being there, going into the Edmonton room, going up to Chris Russell and saying, dude, what the fuck?
Can't you just be happy that Henrik shot the puck? Can't we just have that moment? Like, that in itself was a victory. Now, I'm with you. It would have been, you can't even wrap your head around if they had each scored an overtime game winner to walk away from 17 seasons in the National Hockey League. But Chris Russell plays to the final whistle. That's what he does. He's Western Canada personified. And he robbed Henrik, and he apparently robbed you of this moment as well. So off into the
history. Like, have you not, like, why are you?
I've moved on.
Did nothing get to you?
I've moved on. And we got to move on because there's a lot to get to. It's our season ending podcast, and again, I'm not going to go down the emergency podcast route, but you know, as things progress in the offseason and as news becomes apparent, we'll still get together and record podcasts, but we may back off a little bit. We'll see how the weeks ahead here go, draft lottery, and then on to the draft itself. But we haven't done one of these since the season ended, and it ended on Saturday. Monday was the annual clean out the locker day and meet the management, meet some of the players. It was a select group of players that were presented to the media. But let's go with the management and coach. And again, if the Canucks are asking my advice, then they don't. It's funny how that works. But like Travis Green has handled media all season by himself, standing up there at the podium, and he was fine at it. He did a good job. I thought, you know, of all the things he did this year, he handled first year on the job in the NHL, handled the media part just fine. Could we not separate the coach from the president and the general manager and have two separate availabilities? Because there's lots of questions that were for the coach, and then there were other questions that were more management-based, and it just seems like they kind of serve as their own deflector shields up there when it's the three of them. And refresh my memory, was Jim Benning on the podium on Monday?
That is as quiet and as subdued as Benning as I couldn't believe it. I'm like, was Benning like that last year? So I went back and watched last year's press, or good chunks of it.
Man, you go back in time an awful lot. Do you go back and listen to other old podcasts just for fun?
It's part of the job. And he was like, had his chest out, his shoulders were back. He was super confident about talking about adding depth and how the next season the team wouldn't be in the same injury situation, that they would have more depth to be able to handle it. Of course, that didn't happen. He definitely had a look this year of a guy who was asked to play it down. Don't be too confident. Don't be too boastful. I'm convinced and have heard that their direction heading into that press conference was to kind of under-promise, undersell. Because even like a couple of weeks earlier, he was on with Murph talking about, well, the Sedins are going, how are you going to replace these guys? And he was like, free agents, we're going to get guys. And you didn't hear any of that on Monday. And in fact, I did ask, like, how are you guys going to fix the defense? And I was looking at Trevor and Jim. They both at the same time leaned back and they looked right at Travis and they waited until Travis answered. And so he answered and I actually had to interrupt. And I said, no, like, this is for you, Trevor. Like, how are you guys going to get over this obstacle and fix this thing? And they did say at that point, like, well, we'll look. If we can get something in free agency that works, we'll go for it. But definitely that was super subdued. Jim, super subdued. Trevor, and again, Travis stole the show. And if I were Trevor and Jim, I see why they bring Travis Green there, because he is the team's best spokesman. He is the team's best salesperson. He is able to talk in a way like you believe, okay, he has a plan. He knows things. Like, they're 26th overall this season they finished. They finished barely ahead of last year. But somehow, it feels way better. And I don't know why, because they, you know, Besser is part of it. But other than Besser, there wasn't a big explosion by any player that had some out-of-world season or took a huge step where he would say, right, they're going to be okay because of who? Like, Horvat was okay, but he had basically the same season he had last year. And some of the other guys, Virtanen, Goldobin, you know, mixed results at best. Ben Hutton disappeared. Troy Stetcher, okay, a little bit of improvement. I mean, their best story other than Besser was probably Edler, and he's into his 30s. Like, he's not a guy that you can build around moving forward. But,
well, just let me stop you. Two guys you didn't mention that had pretty good years don't play here anymore, Daniel and Henrik Sedin. They both had a bump in production, and that was, you know, the team scored 40 more goals than it did a year ago, and Besser was a huge part of that, but Daniel was one of the guys that had a spike in his production. Henrik obviously didn't with his three, but even looking at their year-end statistics, Daniel, Henrik, Thomas Vanek, there's three of the top six scorers on the Canucks this year. They're all gone. Edler was in the top six among their final scorers as well, so when it comes to forwards that are coming back next year, it's Horvat and Besser were the only two forwards in the top six of scoring that are going to be back next year.
Yeah, more great points. Like, the Sedins going, it should be It should be a time of feeling down and sorrow and like, we're in this black hole. What are we going to do to get out of it? And I do feel a big part of changing that feeling in the entire city and in the media, the way the team is covered, the way the team is talked about, in the middle of all of that, having a major impact in a positive way is Travis. Like, I really, like, I listen to him and I buy in. Like, I listen to him say, like, you know, we're trying to build these, turn these guys into winners. I'm hard on them because at the other end of it, we're going to have guys that can play. We're going to have guys that I can win with. And I'm buying what he's selling. Maybe some of it's misplaced. But certainly when hearing him talk, you are convinced that he knows what he's doing. When the other two guys, Jim and Trevor, speak, I'm not sure that they do know what they're doing, in terms of having a specific plan about where the team is going to get from where it is now to a competitive team that can win playoff games and can win playoff series. And like this question, and I posed it, others have posed it. Like, I don't think it's this impossible question that people keep saying, no one can answer this and Trevor can't answer that. And that's totally unfair. Like, there's nothing wrong with saying we have a 3 to 5 year plan of how we're going to get a team into the playoffs. Like, I think we'd all accept that. And I would be comfortable with them saying that. I'd be like, okay, I would be more into it if they said, I have a 3 to 5 year plan of how we are going to be winners, as opposed to them constantly going, I don't know, you never can tell, which they seem to be saying, and which was also that same sentiment reflected in that bizarre, the bizarre 15, the April 15 tweets out of owner Francesco Aquilini, which said, well, you know, look at Colorado and look at Arizona's second half and look at Jersey. They did it. So maybe we can do it too. Like, come on, man. Like, that's, none of that feels like a concrete plan to me, and nothing I've heard out of Jim or Trevor so far in this year has felt like they've got a plan to get this team back to the playoffs.
Right. And New Jersey and Colorado both led by Hart Trophy candidates that were superhuman and took their teams on their backs. The Canucks certainly don't have that player. So, I mean, I have some issues with that comparison. We'll get to the TweetStorm 15 a little later on. I want to stay with Monday because, again, we haven't done a podcast since then. I think if there was a mic drop moment, it was from Travis Green, and it involved Ben Hutton, who is going to be, well, he was in the crosshairs all season long and will be again this offseason when we found out that he's going to join a track club and he's going to run. And I have this vision of, like, Ben Hutton living this offseason with some sort of camera on him at all time, where Travis Green would have the option of tuning in, but I don't know if he'd take the option. Like, I just don't know if he can, at this point in this stage of their relationship, I don't know if he could be bothered to check in on Ben Hutton and his summer offseason workout routine, but I just envision somebody following Ben Hutton around so that in real time, at any point in time, Travis Green could just click a couple buttons and see what Ben Hutton was up to. But the mic drop moment was when Bulis tried to ask Travis Green about Ben Hutton's strengths, to which Travis Green said, he kept coming back like, what strengths? What are his strengths? Does he have strengths? This is a third-year pro in the National Hockey League, and the head coach is asking, does he have strengths?
Well, first, I think that for whatever reason, he gives Bulis a hard time. Like, I don't think that that's the first time this year where he's challenged Bulis and said, like, what are you talking about? He basically said, what are you talking about? So I'm not sure how much of it was him calling, like, wanting to call out Ben Hutton and suggest that his defenseman has no strengths, which was the suggestion, and how much of it was, you know what, Bulis, like, I don't like the way you're asking this question, and I'm going to respond to it. Because Bulis had done, like, he's done lots of work all year, really good stuff about the data, about the pairings, about how Ben Hutton's better than you think, and how the analytics can show you that, about how Hutton with Tanev was the team's best pairing this season. In fact, there were stretches where it was among the best pairings in the entire NHL in terms of possession and controlling shot attempts. and also in how could Branson just totally sewered Ben Hutton. And the worst thing, honestly, that ever happened to Ben Hutton was the good Branson acquisition and this concept that Huddy and Guddy could be a thing. Like, Huddy and Guddy is all, like, they've been, like, that's been the worst, that's been among the worst duos I've ever seen. In turn, like, it's oil and water with those two guys. And it has been right from the beginning and early on, good Branson saying, you know, he doesn't get it and he won't get it until he plays his 300 games. And it goes on to how they've been together this season and they really struggled. Look, Green was super hard on Hutton. He was super hard on him all year. And all year, like several times, I asked Hutton, like, what about this fitness thing, man? Like, are you upset about this? Is there anything you're going to do about it? And he would be, and he often said, like, I'm not sure. I'll wait to the off season. Of course, it's upsetting to hear. But after it was all done, he certainly had a series of answers that were opposed to the ones that I heard earlier in the year when he talked about his running group. He talked about his commitment and he talked about how things were going to change. So maybe after it all, Green ended up getting through to him. From what I've heard, that there was a point in the season where they needed Hutton to lose weight. He struggled in losing weight for a while. He finally did it. Then he had to maintain the weight. He struggled maintaining the weight. And there were times, and like obviously if Green is telling the media that he's that his guy is struggling with fitness and conditioning, when they're in meetings together, he's telling the guy, you're struggling with fitness and conditioning. It's not good enough. I did hear that one of his trainers, one of the trainers on the team at one point stood up for Hutton and said, no, like, look, he is strong. Like, he's not, you know, he's not like a little baby out there. Like, he does have some strength. So possibly I'll hold out a small percentage that all of this tough love routine was about getting through to him. They're going to get improved a player in the fall. But I can't wrap my head around really, like, in the big picture, does he fit with the team? Does he fit with Travis Green? Does he fit with the one thing that I think Travis Green is going to want more than anything else this summer? And that's to have a team that's harder to play against. I think it drives him crazy and drove him nuts all year, how soft the Vancouver Canucks were. Does Hutton get you any harder to play against? Does Hutton get you any less soft? And I think the answer to that is no.
And I can vouch for Ben Hutton that, you know, those nights when he was a healthy scratch and in the press box, like, I didn't see him, you know, chowing down on pretzels and popcorn. And, you know, some of those press boxes had some pretty good stuff up there, ice cream bars. And I didn't ever see Hutton at the trough.
Didn't someone ask him if he's fat?
Yeah, Janauer asked him. He said, you don't look fat. To which Hutton said, well, thanks. I appreciate that. But he did look beaten down. Like, he's a guy that in the first 2.5 seasons of the NHL, he loved living the NHL life probably more than anybody. I mean, just that goofy grin of his at every turn. And in the second half of the season, when he wasn't getting in the lineup, you know, that smile had disappeared. Like, we saw him. I remember talking to him in Phoenix just ahead of the trade deadline when there was some suggestion that he might be on the move. Like, that was as low as I remember seeing him. I think his spirits improved a little bit toward the end. So I don't know if there was a thaw in that coach-player relationship, but we'll see what happens there. But it does lead to the fact that this organization simply cannot come back with the same defense. So they do have to make some changes, whether it's Hutton and Tanev, whether it's Hutton, Tanev, good brands. Like, I don't know how far you go. Do you throw dynamite on that defensive depth chart? But, you know, they've got this cap space now. If they're going to bring guys in, then some guys are going to have to go. And even if they don't bring guys in, again, there's this big log jam on the left side. We've talked about that in the past, but how extensive then, as we sit here today, do you anticipate the changes on the back end for this hockey club? Because Travis Green, again, on Monday said, well, he pointed out 6 assists. Like, that was one of the, you know, he came armed with Ben Hutton's statistics. That was one thing. But the other one is, you know, it's fine to throw your hands in the air and say, we need more from this defense, but this defense is entirely under contract, or at least under club control. So unless there are some major changes, you are coming back with the pretty much the same makeup of your defense. Where is this increased offense going to come from?
Yeah, I think that they'll definitely try to sign a free agent or two. I think that Tanev will be legitimately on, you know, an option to trade. I think Tanev's camp thought that when they saw the Good Branson deal, and saw that the right shot, Gudbranson there was signed for the next 3 years. And, you know, I've made this point before, but if you map it out and you've got your top two pairings and you've got Gudbranson at the right side on one, you've got Tanev on the other, you're not producing much offense at all from either of those pairings. So something has to give there. I'm kind of hesitant on Tanev because his value is going to be down. The sheer number of injuries are going to have an impact on that. But they also have an impact on the Vancouver Canucks saying like, okay, he may be our best defenseman, but if he's never in the lineup, he's not really helping us. So I think that the injuries, it's twofold, have made the Canucks more open to the possibility of trading him. But in turn, they've made it less opportune in terms of the market, his value, and what they may get back. So I think it still has to fit in the right ways for him to move. But if he doesn't go, it's going to be really difficult for them to kind of change things around. And even if they bring in a DeHaan or someone who they think can produce more offense, I don't really consider Carlson an option. But is it going to, like, they scored this year and they're running gun style and we're moving the puck up the ice and we're going to be super aggressive. The defense, even if on a big run to end the season in terms of production, still ended up with fewer goals than they did a year ago. And I think collectively only had 113 points. There's teams in the league, a couple of 200. I saw the top four and I think number four or five had 189. Like, they're way off being a top producing NHL defense. They're way off at being acceptable. I think that they have to be more open to change. Ben Hutton for sure on the trade block. Chris Tanev a possibility. But here's the problem that they have. They're all in on Gudbranson right now and they're all in on Delzato. So those are two guys who I would suggest to you on none of these playoff teams would be playing on the top four. So if those guys are playing top 4 minutes next year for the Vancouver Canucks, they're going to have a hard time making their six, making the blue line six a really effective top six defense.
Pat Cass coming to you from Woody's Pub & Co. Quitlam. April is truck month at Eagle Ridge GM. Get up to $11,000 total value on the largest selection of Silverados and Sierras in stock. Go to eagleridgegm.com for full details. Now, Botch, and I'm sure you've got your intel here, but there's part of me that thinks you should be wearing, like, overalls and one of those conductor's hats, because I've heard you a few times now driving the Calvin DeHaan train around Vancouver. You know how many goals Calvin DeHaan had this year for the New York Islanders?
Yeah, he had a rough year, though. He had a bad year.
He had one. He had one goal. He didn't play that much. I think he's 33 games. So
makes him available.
But
that's why he's not re-signing with the Islanders. That's why it's expected that he's not going to resign with the Islanders.
But a career high five, like, I'm not sure that he necessarily fits the profile of some guy that they don't already have right now. Like, that's my concern. I'm not saying that it wouldn't happen, but you look at a guy like Kevin Connaughton in Arizona, had 10 goals from February 1st on. He had 11 on the season. 28-year-old, obviously the Canucks drafted him at one time. Now, I remember when they came through Vancouver and I asked Rick Tocchet about his season, and he said in October and November he wasn't convinced that he could play in the National Hockey League. You know, this is a coach of one of the last-place teams in the NHL. That's not a huge ringing endorsement for Kevin Connaughton. But Kevin Connaughton had 11 goals on the season on an Arizona team behind a guy like Oliver Ekman-Larsson. Like, to me, that's a guy that might have some more offensive upside. I just throw that name out there because he too is a UFA. Although, you know, we say this every year in April, we talk about potential UFAs. A lot of these guys never even make it to market.
No, true. And like I don't know who you want me to name, like Carlson. Like, there's like the possibility of a top end legitimate offensive producer coming to Vancouver is super slim. Yeah, would they be interested in Carlson? Sure, they would. Maybe on, you know, but is he interested in coming to a bad team in a Canadian market? For what reason? It doesn't really make much sense. So, you're going to have to take a chance on guys. I'm just trying to pick out guys, around the league who you can take chances on. And Don's, you know, former first round pick, was super, very highly rated. Like, he had a brutal year. He's not going to be signed by the Islanders. So that's an opportunity, could be an opportunity for them. And one of the guys that I've heard that they're interested in, you know, this summer. And then you look up front. Like, I think Bozak's camp thinks that the Canucks are coming for Bozak. And they will have a hole to fill at center with Henrik going. They're going to need an offensive-minded guy. We all know what's going to happen with Brandon Sutter. He's going to play tough minutes. He's going to play, you know, I think he was at the right at the top of the league in terms of numbers or percentages of defensive zone starts. He played among the hardest minutes in the NHL in center, and that's not going to change. But they are going to need a guy to help Bo Horvat, you know, another center to give him some kind of secondary scoring, because we know by now that the coach is not going to expect any offense out of the Sutter line. So where are they going to find that guy? And that's why what leads me and has led others to say, like, Bozak could be one of the guys that the Canucks could be interested in.
You've also sort of started down the path of Brandon Saad, which is an interesting one to me. Like, I'd like to see the Canucks get creative and use their cap space in different ways rather than just going out and going for volume signings like they did on July 1st last year, because I think we agree that last July 1st was a complete flop. When you look at the return on the investment, when you look at the number of players, I mean, Burmistrov and Rodin both walked away. Wierkoch never got a chance. We know the Gagne story. Delzato played all 82 games, but, you know, at what cost in terms of the development of younger guys behind him? And Anders Nilsson, you know, that's another story in and of itself. Like, so they can go back into the open market on July 1st with all this money and spend it, but I'm not sure that I have full confidence that they'll spend it effectively. But I think, and if they were to trade Tanev, that would free up some more space as well. Like, I'd like to see them pursue the trade angle, and that's when I heard you mention Brandon Saad. Like, I got intrigued there because, A, I like the player, but I also think there are some ways that the Canucks could go about making a deal like that happen that I would consider creative, that would be a good use of their cap space rather than just throwing bad money after marginal players.
Yeah, like Saad would be, that would be a sly, slick move for the Vancouver Canucks. I'm not sure that Bowman would be willing to do it. You know, and I've made the point of the trade when they gave up Panarin to get him, who's kind of turned into a star. I think he had 80 points this year. So it looks like a really bad trade for them right now. So would he give him, would, you know, the Hawks be willing to move him for a cut rate price? I'm not sure on that, but I do think, like, he's a super intriguing buy low candidate. He is for sure a player. Like, he's legit a good player. And I do think that that's kind of how they're going to view the cap space. I don't think necessarily they're going to, like, look at the Spezzas of the world taking on players who can't really play anymore. I think that they're going to look for players who are good but overpaid a bit. And Saad definitely kind of fits that model. But, you know, it's super early in the whole process. So we'll see, where it ends up. Chicago will be looking to make some kind of moves. They will be looking to shake things up. And that's a team that's, you know, part of the reason that they made that trade was cap space.
Right. So, you know, then to me, just off the top of my head, I look at, you know, you got Saad. There's the Hossa contract there. You know, Berchi needs a contract here. Ben Hutton, you know, they need defensemen. Tanev, like, yeah, again, I'd like to see this management group get creative. I don't think that they've thought outside the box an awful lot in their 4 years on the job here.
It's such a good point. Like, everything should be on the table. Like, they can't dismiss anything. Like, Berchi, for one. Like, that's a potential. I look at what Tatar got back. Like, get Berchi. Put him, try to, you know, get a market going for him. It's still a promising forward with upside, a guy who can count on to score 18 goals, possibly on a really good team, on a good line, could get you a lot more or significantly more than that. Is it decent two-way numbers, some... You know, he's had some impressive, or at least more than adequate, better than average data behind him over the years. So I would look at him. There's no one I would not look at, when they have the spreadsheet out and they're looking at all these players and what possible moves they can make to shake things up. and their number one priority should be exactly that. Like, shake things up. Like, don't come back with the same group depending on these same guys. I think Goldobin could do what Berchi did. You put Goldobin in Berchi's situation, I bet you could score 15, 18 goals in that. So why not have him play in that spot? And why not try to sell high for once, or high-ish, on a guy like Berchi? Why always, you know, sit on these assets until they really don't have much value anymore? And I'm afraid that that's what they've done with a guy like Ben Hutton.
You're not being dispatched to Utica to follow the Comets on their playoff run?
No. I saw that you were dreading. You had this tweet where you're like, you know, I dread life without covering, you know, hockey games every day. And I'm like, holy fuck. Like, that's, it was quite the, you know, not much gets to you, that cold, dark heart of yours. I'm just surprised that the one thing that does is not covering a hockey game. Like, I'm super excited not to be covering a hockey game. Like, our days were like so brutally long. Like, how can you not, like, what do you miss about it?
Am I right? My wife read that and she's like, you hate the family that much that like you're that upset there's no hockey? Like, it just, when you day in, day out, and I know you're there most of the time, but you got a few days off along the way. You know, I was there from the first day of Penticton right through Edmonton the other night. So it becomes, no, I'm not the victim card at all. Don't go there. I'm just saying it becomes what you do, who you are. It's your life. And so then Monday was clean out the locker day. I wake up Tuesday and I'm like, now what? Like, what do I do? And so that was just an expression of, I've got like a day where I'm not sure what I've got. Like, I don't have anything to do with myself. And that's all it was.
More podcasts, maybe. Could start up another podcast.
I might. I'll see what Kuz is up to.
No, like, I know that you really like this idea. I've heard you talk about this, you know, more than once, about how you covered all 82 games and how incredible it was and how you should have some kind of badge, like you wear it around like a tattoo or right on your shoulder sleeve saying all 82. And I just want to point out, like, You did have a lot of time in those 82 games to go see sights. Like, even in St. Louis, you're off sightseeing. You're having a great time in New York, walking the streets. You know, Washington, you're doing the tour of D.C., absorbing all the big highlights. One of your famous walkabouts was in Boston, where I was exhausted typing away, writing. I just want to point out that while you're having all that enjoyable time, I'm in the rink. All of those games that I'm covering, I never, like, I get there at 10 a.m. I don't leave till 1 a.m. Like, I am in there rock solid. So I honestly think my 62 games is equal to your 82 games in terms of time spent. I just want to point that out.
It's a big world out there, man. You got to get out of the rink once in a while. You should. There are things to see. And then you got jealous of, like, my Instagram account and the photos that I was posting, because you're right.
You're a great photographer. Like, you for sure. I think I found out you took a course or something like that. Like, you are, you know, I'm actually jealous of the way that, I'm jealous of two things. The one, you got Brock Besser and I didn't. And you're a very good photographer in terms of setting the scene and the sights. And I didn't, like, I didn't want to believe it, because I did see, like, you out there shooting New York and shooting some of these cities. And I'm like, well, how hard is it to make, like, New York look good? But your shots, and I even went back, go back every once in a while, and I'm like, is his shots of St. Louis, are they that incredible? And I'll, like, creep on your IG to just go back and look at your picturesque, because I hate going to St. Louis. Like, in my mind, it's drab and ugly and it sucks and downtown's brutal and I never want to go. I can't believe I'm, like, Kuz has made me go again and again, and I'm there. I feel like I'm in St. Louis all the time. And then I look at your photos and you've got, like, Busch Stadium, you've got that stupid fucking arch thing that they have, which, like, when you're there, is like the worst highlight of any city ever, because, like, it's an optical illusion. Like, the St. Louis is like Kits. Like, there's no big buildings, so this the arch looks like this massive, you know, piece of architecture, and it's not at all. Like, it's super small. Like, I think, like, you know, there's multiple buildings downtown in Vancouver that would tower over it, but you somehow made it look incredible. And I think you did say, like, even you had, like, comments about, you know, three-point perspective or something like that. You have all these photographer terms. So, no, I do give you credit for your photography.
But I did learn early in the season, like originally I was posting a lot of those pictures on Facebook, and my wife is a Facebook friend of mine. She's not on IG. So she would see these pictures on Facebook and like you said, like, damn, like this guy's in New York and like he's left the family and look at, he's just having an amazing time. And then I would never hear the end of it when I'd get home. Yeah. And she's like, I'm driving the kids and I'm doing laundry and you're out in New York and you're in Chicago. And so I quickly realized I couldn't post those on Facebook. So I post the good ones on Instagram. Don't tell anybody. This is my secret. But so the good pictures went to Instagram because she's not on IG. So I would just post occasional pictures from the road on Facebook.
I can see why, because like I'm looking at those shots of St. Louis and I'm like, fuck, I want to go to St. Louis. Like, I start catching myself saying that. I'm like, wait a minute. You hate St. Louis. You never want to go there. And I was in the city and I'm looking at these photos going, man, I'd really, really like to walk around and experience this stuff that JPEG does.
Well, we established your hatred for St. Louis early on in the podcast when you told the story you couldn't find the pharmacy and I didn't believe you. But now after being to St. Louis, they've got an arch, but they don't have anything else. So I totally believe that part. I've had so many people now that the season's over, you know, what was the highlight? And I'm not going to get into all of the highlights here. But one thing that we didn't discuss, and I think we have to, is the final road trip that we were on together was Vegas, and then Chicago, St. Louis, and it ended in Dallas. And I don't know that we can do this justice, but people in Vancouver, like Vancouver has become a cycle-centric city, and people know like these rental bike things like in downtown, you know, there's those rows of bikes and you can credit card and you rent your bike and away you go. They've got these in Dallas, but neither one of us totally understood. Like, it looks like a giant truck is just driven around downtown Dallas and randomly tossed green and yellow bikes on every street corner. Like, there was no rhyme or reason whatsoever, but there were bikes. It was like a bike wasteland of these rental bikes, but they were just strewn everywhere.
Yeah, it's like a post-apocalyptic scene, and it's hard for people, unless you experience it, it's like really hard to register. But like every street corner, there are like dozens of bikes overturned, upside down, thrown against walls, at sides, and I'm like they don't lock up anywhere. The people buy, like have their app. They somehow have a code on the bike. They ride it, and then they just throw it somewhere and leave it there. And it was like, I was at a different hotel than you, but I went right by your hotel as I was going to the rink, and I was looking around. Like, there was like 300 yellow bikes in a two-block radius just filling up the side streets. I can't believe that people live like that. Like, every Uber I got in, I was like, what is the fucking deal with these bikes everywhere? And they're like, oh, every guy, oh, don't get me started on that. Don't let me get into that one. And I'm like, dude, you guys got to do something about like this is, I don't know. I like Dallas is nice, but I don't want to go there and like be walking over bikes everywhere you go. It's, I did want to see you. I asked you to, you know, use the app and bike to the rink, but you took a pass.
As did everyone. Like, neither one of us ever saw a person riding one of these bikes. They're everywhere. We'll see if you go back to the draft in June. Maybe we'll have to go for a little tandem bike ride.
Okay, when we are there in June, you got to do pictures and IGs, that bike scene, man, because people will be shocked at some of the pics that you'll get from that.
All right, I want to wrap things up here from Woody's Pub, postseason PatCast. You mentioned it earlier. What did you make of the Twitter 15 the other night?
Well, I thought it ran counter to a lot of, like, I did think that the management was successful for the Canucks in presenting an under, like, I think the market was hungry to be under promised. Like, I think people were ready to hear things like, there's going to be cap space. We're not going to go into free agency. We're going to go with the young guys. Like, those messages, I think had a, you know, really kind of connected with where a lot of people hope that this rebuild goes. And I thought that Francesco kind of undid some of that, especially in the tweets where he was saying like, Look at Colorado. Look at New Jersey. This thing can be turned around quickly. And that was kind of the message that I was getting from those tweets. And I was like, man, like, I'm not sure that that's kind of, it felt a little tone deaf to me. Obviously he's got a PR team behind him. Someone came up with the idea because, I mean, Aquilini is not like 1 out of 15, 2 out of 15. Like, someone came up with this idea. And the prelude to that, where he was like hyping up all kinds of stuff, like the Raptors. Like, Francesco can't name one Raptor. Come on. Like, there's no way he's naming a Raptor, but he's tweeting about the Raptors. And then he goes into this big take about the Canucks. And I thought that some of it, you know, was valid, and some of that was great, and some of that was kind of, we apologize to the fans and thanks for standing by us, and there will be a better tomorrow. And all those messages are good. But saying, hey, Colorado didn't make the playoffs and Jersey didn't, like, Colorado's got a ton of like legit, really good NHL players. They've got a Hart Trophy candidate. They've got Tyson Barrie, who had like, what, 50 something points, and they still barely made the playoffs. Like, the Canucks are so far away from having a team like that. So saying, hey, we can be the next Colorado, or hey, we can be the next New Jersey, I just felt those ones in particular took it too far. And I was like, oh man, like, just stop while you're ahead. I think the Aquilini Francesco 5, if he just stopped at 5, it would have been fine. I think it went on too long. And a lot of those tweets, like, I saw people already dunking on, and I already saw people like telling me, I'm clipping this for later and I'm going to save it, and he's going to hear about this in a couple of years. I just feel like some of those tweets are going to come back and haunt him.
Well, I just want to know, like, logistically, because if I told you, all right, go on a tweet storm and, like, just go, like, you wouldn't know how many tweets you were going to send. When you send out the first one that says 1 of 15, like, absolutely, it's step by step. And I think it was Blake that pointed out, with 280 characters, really, it could have been 7 tweets. Like, it could have been reduced to half of what it was. Maybe 15 was for effect. But again, when you see 1 of, and you know it's going to be 15, then it was laid out on, like, placards and cue cards. Like, it was scripted behind the scene. And I'm with you. Like, I think that there is either a PR team or a social media staffer now that has been employed by Canucks ownership. I said we're going to wrap things up on that topic, but I can't break our own rule, and that is, I'm not going to let another podcast go by without talking about Louis Erickson, because all season we went through this. Everybody that was around this team went down this path of not talking about the $6 million man. But I saw on Monday, locker cleanout day, I was busy hearing about the track club. I was busy talking to other guys. And I look over, and you've got Louis to yourself. You've kind of cornered him. And he looked uncomfortable, but he looked fashionable in the capris and sockless. Yeah, a new haircut, big belt buckle. What's going on with Louis? I think you've written about him.
Absolutely. I wrote about him. Yeah. What do you think? I'm just hanging out, like, catching up on what he's going to be doing this summer. Yeah. No, I was asking him, like, what the hell happened? What do you expect? And, like, essentially, how bad do you feel? And I think that, like, legitimately, he feels bad. Like, I think he's very frustrated with the way things have gone. I think that he sees himself, as still a guy who can be a top goal scorer. And I think that that gets lost in all the talk about, well, at least he's a good third liner. Well, hold on. Like, he averaged almost 28 goals a season for like 6 straight years in Dallas. He scored 30 in that last year in Boston, 10 on the power play, which was like, you know, top 20 in the NHL. Like, this guy is a legit top scorer and has been his entire career. You can't just dismiss it and say, well, he's a good third liner, we're going to throw up our arms and not worry about him. And Travis is as guilty as anyone, because when we were quizzing him during the season, I'm not worried about Louis Erickson. And I don't believe him for a second. I think that Travis spent a lot of time this year worrying about a guy making $6 million and scoring 10 goals. Okay. And albeit he missed 32 games because of injury, but even if you take his, like, points per 60, his even strength production, it was pitiful. Like, it was bad. Like, it was Yannick. He had a Yannick Hansen season. And I think that you understand how bad that comparison is, because Yannick Hansen had one of the worst seasons, you know, a healthy scratch all the time, couldn't find a line mate. And that's one of the counters that Louis did have. He said, like, I do hope that people understand that a good portion of this year, actually a quarter of it, I was playing in a matchup role with Brandon Sutter, who has been a black hole for offense, was a black hole for offense this entire year until like late in the season where the games didn't matter anymore. And he scored eight, actually led the team in those final, the great nine that ended the year. He led the team with 8 points. But up until then, he couldn't produce anything. And Erickson said, like, I hope people that are kind of judging me on my stats understand that a big part of it was in a defensive shutdown role. And it's very difficult to produce like that. And he also said a lot of the same things that we've heard from Verbata before. I can't find a consistent line mate. I need to know who I'm playing with. You know, I got to find, if I'm going to produce like I used to, I need some consistency. I'm not sure Travis Green is the guy for consistency, but I do know that at that arena, in that building, in those head offices, there are people who think he is among the guys set up to benefit the most without the Sedin twins. That with Henrik and Daniel gone, there's going to be a primo spot on power play one that hopefully Erickson can take. He didn't, like, for all the talk about him fitting well with the Sedins, they never really produced a lot of goals when they were playing together. He didn't score a lot of goals when they were playing together. 2 years, just 21 goals. Maybe there's a better fit for him and a consistent top six role. And maybe it's a situation where he'll have a spot and Travis will stop putting him back into a defensive shutdown spot. I think Green's got to give up on that. I think that he has to try to rehab Erickson. Like, he's signed for too long. He makes too much money. If you're not going to trade him, and I think there's a way that I don't think it's as hard as people think. For one, he's already made $16 million. He's owed $6 million more on July 1, so that's 22. He's left $14 million over the next 4 years. That's not bad. You know, that's, you know, could be affordable for a kind of buy low situation for another team, maybe. But Green has to try to rehab him. They have to try to find the guy that can score 24 goals. If they're going to make up for what the Sedins have left behind, he's one of the top guys that has at least the potential to do that because he's done it elsewhere. I said to him, I did say this, has it gone away? Is that guy still inside you? The guy who scored 30, the guy who scored 27 in Dallas, 28 in Dallas. And he said, it is. It is still inside me. Sometimes I doubt it. Sometimes I'm not sure. Sometimes I'm lacking confidence. But it is in there. I'm still in good shape, and I believe in it. And for a moment in time, when you saw me off in that corner, I was looking at him. We had eye contact, and I was like, this is the first time I've believed in you, Louis. Don't let me down.
All right, Botch doesn't let you down either. Another podcast coming your way from Woody's Pub. It's always a presentation of Eagle Ridge GM out in Coquitlam. Proud sponsors of community hockey, Eagle Ridge GM, your one-stop car and truck center where everybody's a part of their hockey family. Check them out online, eagleridgegm.com. People here at Woody's can see, but for people that are listening to the podcast, we've got our jerseys for Humboldt on as well. Botch is rocking the Joey Bats Blue Jays, blue Jose Bautista. I have gone for, I had to reach deep into my hockey bag to find, back in the 2004-05, the lockout season, the lost season in the National Hockey League, Mark Crawford and Mike Johnson, the Canucks, put the media through a boot camp, essentially 2 days of like practices, and then we played a game at, it was GM Place at the time. And so I've got my media training camp. I didn't get cut from that training camp somehow, some way, made the grade and got to play in the game. So that's the jersey that I have chosen for this particular night. Again, podcast will continue here through the off season. I'm not sure the frequency, but with social media, we'll let you know when we get back behind the mics and when the Canucks make some news. We'll certainly get together to record another edition of the PatCast here on Province Radio.